My name is Becky Ryan, and today is May 12th, 2009, and I'm here to interview Ann Wallace for the Oral History Project. Hello, Ann.
Hello, Becky.
So we're just going to start off with some background about you, your education, and how you ended up in higher education. So I'm turning the floor over to you.
I came here to go to school as a 17-year-old undergraduate, 1959, majored in sociology. Got my degree in 1963, and during my senior year, I'd worked as a student hourly for the professor who was my advisor. $1.25 an hour. But the thing it did for me was get me into the department. I was interacting with the graduate students and interacting with the professors. I was around more than a typical student would be. So I did my little coding job on this fairly small project. Got a footnote in an article, and when it came time to get a job, I was doing the usual interviewing and looking around at places that liberal arts graduates looked, including the Social Security Administration. Did I want to go to Baltimore? Not really. So I was talking with my advisor, and he said, we have a new grant that starts the 1st of July, 1963. Russell Sage Foundation is sponsoring a sociology and law program. We need a staff person who can do many of the same things that you did on this project for me, working with professors, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and he named them, and I'd had classes from three of them. And we chatted about the nature of the job, and they decided to give it to me. There's a question here about interview process. I really wasn't interviewed. There wasn't a posting of the job in 1963. These people just knew me, and so they said, fine, when July 1st rolls around, when the grant began, come and work for us. And so I showed up on the 1st of July, and they showed me where my office was. Had nothing for me to do that day, so I ran off to the Memorial Union and became a lifetime member. That was my first day of work. But it was, they got their act together eventually. And I was the staff person on this project. And it gradually morphed into the executive director, working with the executive director of the Law and Society Associations. We had a professional association that involved people from the law school and poli-sci and other people besides sociologists. So I had exposure at that point to a broader range of people. I worked on that project until 1970, when I went off to New York for a year. One of the professors on this, one of the five, on this project had a leave at Columbia, and he secured some money for me to work at the Center for Policy Research across the street from Columbia. So I had a chance to spend 9.5 months in Manhattan working the same kind of support tasks I had been doing all along. Going to the libraries and going to the various hospitals because he was looking into medical sociology. And had a wonderful time in New York, came back because he was on leave. I knew I was coming back. Went back to a little different project with that same PI and some others. It also in sociology, there was a social organization training grant that I was the staff person for. Then the same professor went off to Santa Cruz, California in a permanent move for him. Because my job was moving, I thought, well, I'll move too. Hated California, hated Santa Cruz, came back after a year, and spent four more years in the social department working for Dave Mechanic, a medical sociologist, until he went to Rutgers. I seem to have this knack for driving away professors. Dave went to Rutgers, and I worked for another few months in the social department when a very significant transition took place. I heard about a job in the education dean's office working with the dean. It was a social professor who didn't get tenure, whose wife was a student of the education dean. And he said, Ann, there's this job in education and you'd be perfect for it. Why don't you call John? I didn't know how to say no to Ken. So I said, well, all right, I'll do it. And here I am. You know, it worked out well. John and I were very compatible. And I had much broader exposure to campus life than I would have if I'd stayed in the social department. So what that tells you is that I was in the social department, worked there for 15 years, 2 years away, and then I worked 26 years in the education dean's office, from which I retired officially in 2005. Came back and worked, 9.5 months or so at halftime to help the new dean, Julie Underwood, with the transition. So that, in a nutshell, is how I got my first job.
Okay. So the second job you interviewed for, the School of Ed job, or you were invited to apply and or just invited to do it?
I was just told that the job existed. Ken McNeil knew that the job had been posted because his wife Linda was John Palmer's last graduate student. And he knew that Dorothy, the woman that I replaced, was about to retire. And so he said, go talk to John.
So it was fate.
It was fate. Totally. But the job had, that one had been posted. This was in a much different era when you were doing things much more by the book. In 63, meh. And interestingly, my title in 1963 was project assistant for the first 3 years. So I had the same title that graduate assistants had. Then somebody wised up to the fact that this shouldn't be. And there was a title structure instituted, more about that later, that affected me, and I became a project supervisor. So okay, I avoided the specialist series that was so common for academic staff members in those days.
Okay. I only know a little bit about the specialist thing. So that was when the university was growing and they didn't have a structure.
Right. Or they came up with this structure, which included very many kinds of specialists.
Okay.
I was in the dean's office for a little while. I was specialist administrative support. And there were, I don't even know the titles anymore, but there were a disproportionate number of academic staff people who were called specialist, which meant it was a meaningless title.
Even though it had special in the
title.
Even though
it had special, right.
So when you got into the School of Ed, is that when you became aware of this, more about this population that we're talking about, specialists?
Well, not quite. It was before then, actually, and this is thanks to Joanne Elder also. When I came back from California in 1975, MESA had begun, the workings of it were beginning, and there were several of us who sat around Joanne Elder's dining room table ever so many times, putting together mailings and working on other things like the newsletter. I was involved with the newsletter for a while. That was my exposure to the fact that there are larger issues out there. And because MESA was there, Madison Academic Staff Association, that gave me a sense of what other people were going through, and other people's situation was not as good as mine.
So you were in the School of Ed, Joanne Elder was, or sociology.
I was, and so was
Elder
Joanne,
was in sociology,
right.
So
and then there were other people that
so
were
by
not
the time
social.
You moved to the School of Education, you had already had a good
4 years.
Okay.
Or so of working with other campus people.
So what spawned MASA? What was going on in 75 that...
There are others better able to answer that question. Okay. I think it had partly to do with the specialist titles and the lack of rights that people had. It always boils down to that. People aren't getting what they think they should have. But I wasn't affected by that, so I'm in no position really to answer that. I just knew that it was an organization that was for academic staff members. It was an information dispensing group. For example, we used to have programs, as MASA still does, and a newsletter. Mm-hmm. Which was very involving, and again, because I was working, Dick Olson was the editor, and I was the person. I actually typed that thing on a typewriter. We didn't have this was pre-computers in the time between 75 and roughly 80. I don't know exactly how long I did it. But it was a way to get involved and be informed about what the issues were.
Excellent. Stay connected.
Stay connected, absolutely.
So, why did it matter to you? I mean, you obviously...
It was a broader issue. It was a broader issue. I was okay because through the luck of the draw, I had some good PIs to work for. Because I was working on all soft money up until 1980, a series of grant-funded training projects or research projects. But everybody wasn't that lucky, so I just figured, let's get some information here.
So you thought, I'm going to just help out. I'm going to play a
Correct.
Role.
Correct.
Even though it wasn't out of your own personal need.
Correct.
For
it wasn't,
more.
Correct. That's a very good way to put it. It wasn't my own personal need. It was just something bigger. And I, of course, had tremendous respect for Joanne. And if she said it was worth doing, it was worth doing. And I was meeting some people outside my workplace, which was also... Like Bob Miller, who became the first secretary of the academic staff, was sitting around that same dining room table. So just it was a good chance to get involved.
Excellent. So... Tell us more about those years of P people starting to organize and starting to care about the bigger issues. Who was listening or who wasn't listening? What were you doing to try to get some credibility?
I don't remember when the Academic Staff Committee was begun. That was the precursor to ASEC and the precursor to governance. ASC was partly elected and partly appointed. The appointed people tended to be people well known, like Marita Weiss from the grad school or Phil Hellmuth from Letters and Science, people who had already some credibility, at least in the administrative world. And then the elected people were volunteers, and MASA helped with some of those elections. And for example, one of the programs that MASA did was candidate forums, where they introduced the candidates to anybody who wanted to come. And I think we probably announced that through the newsletter, although I don't know for sure. That was the major way of informing people then, because we didn't have email.
So candidate forums for the people who are running as an elected position for the
Academic Staff Committee, okay. ASC, right.
So you call ASC.
Mm-hmm.
And how many people were on that committee?
I don't remember. 9, maybe?
Okay, 9-ish.
And I think it was 5 elected, 4 appointed, but I don't remember that for sure.
And they were appointed by?
By the chancellor, I believe.
Okay.
Probably with some input from whoever the relevant people would have been. But we didn't have governance then, so who would the appropriate people have been? I don't know.
That's a good question.
Which is why they tended to be people like Marita and Phil, who were well known already by virtue of their jobs.
And I'm assuming were advocates for the likes of these specialists and academic staff?
Well, pretty much. Although they did have the administrative bent to their approach. I mean, Phil, I used to work with Phil in Letters and Science, Socials in Letters and Science, on certain issues having to do with appointments. So I would say that Phil had an administrative bias, if you will. Mm-hmm. I remember I retired as an assistant dean. I know all about administrative biases. Have it, recognize it, and get on with it. They were well informed because they had these roles as officials in their respective colleges. There might have been some differences. Let's pick on 2 people, between Phil and Joanne Elder, for example. Because Joanne was much more the employee advocate. And I don't know if she was a supporter of unions or not. That was sort of lurking in the background, too. Does academic staff need a union in order to get what they think they need?
Still lurking in the background.
Still lurking in the background. And it's closer to the surface now than it has been for a lot of years.
So back to the appointed. Was it a length of time that they were appointed for?
Probably, but I don't remember.
Okay.
Might have been, I don't know.
And then same with the elected, recollection of whether it was a term.
It's a long time ago. I don't remember for sure. But I know there was a term for the elected people, but it might have been that the appointed were appointed for a year, but they could be reappointed and reappointed. I just don't remember that detail.
Do you recall if there was a lot of interest in the elected positions? Were there people actually...
There were races.
And were they...
There were races.
Now there seems to be sometimes some trouble getting people interested in...
That's correct.
Back then, people came out.
People came out, right. And a variety of people with a variety of reasons for wanting to be involved.
Excellent.
But they tended to be pretty good people who worked together with the appointees and made sure that the academic staff viewpoint was heard loud and clear.
You're coming at this, you're feeling fairly secure in your job, you're playing a role in the bigger campus and people taking an interest in this group of specialists. What are you getting out of it besides access to a broader network? What are you gaining from that involvement?
I didn't think of it in those terms. I think it was the network, it was the fact that this is something bigger here, and if I can do something, I'll do it. I don't remember anything specific. But I always like to be informed on whatever it was. And I just saw this as a way to keep myself up to date on what was happening.
In coming from my perspective, thinking, okay, so it sounds like you're starting off just like, it's the right thing to do. I'm going to be involved. But I see you as a person who, you know, at the forefront, leading the way, you know, keeping people motivated to get involved. So more than just doing it to be a part of the bigger group, it seemed like there was some natural movement there that it really it called to you. It was something that was there.
But you knew me later, Becky.
Right.
Early on, I was not a leader. I didn't know what needed to be done at that point. I wasn't as passionate about some of these things. I did not think unions were a good idea. But I wasn't sufficiently passionate that I wanted to push on something like that. It was partly because of Joanne, who said, I need some help on this. Come and help.
So what caused the switchover then?
Well, then I moved to the School of Education in 1980. This was before we had governance. But in 1980, I started having, again, a broader perspective because I worked in the dean's office. And I was much more aware of people's problems. My dean told me when I interviewed, John Palmer said, we don't have anybody right now who understands this whole academic staff thing. I don't remember what his words were. But he said, we don't have an academic staff expert, and I would like you to become that expert. So I did. I think my original working title was assistant to the dean, but I very quickly morphed into the academic staff, quote, expert, which was very comfortable.
And so what did it mean to be an expert with this group that is so undefined?
Well, I learned more about the appointment structure and the promotion structure and how salaries were established and did people do performance reviews and how did people get hired and just the basic things that became really my job after a certain period of time.
So this is all pre-governance?
This is pre-governance.
Is right. This right around, when did the whole Hayes Hill titling thing come into the mix?
I don't remember the years.
Early 80s?
Was it?
What's always in my head, but
okay.
This is, you know.
Yeah. Hayes Hill was definitely there for me, but I don't remember the years.
Because it transitioned.
Correct.
All of this stuff.
Correct. And Hayes Hill was a significant thing because it completely revamped the title structure. And then I had to learn the title structure also because that was my job in the School of Ed, is to become the expert on that. That
so
title
is that
structure.
What prompted the assignment from the dean to become an expert?
Was no, Hayes Hill wasn't even in the picture.
So it was before then.
It was before then, right? He said, "We don't have this. We need it. You're it." I said, "Fine."
So, what did Hayes Hill do anything for us that was a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it was a good thing.
Okay.
I think it was a good thing because it gave people more descriptive titles than specialist academic support or specialist research support or I don't even remember what the other ones are anymore. But there were, I think, five different kinds of specialists, and then there were five different kinds or several different kinds of, I don't know, some version of project supervisor maybe. This stuff is all gone from my head now because it's so long ago. We had more titles that would describe better what we did. The registrar also always had a good title that would be or advisor. I don't think advisor existed before Hayes Hill either. You were probably called specialist academic support in those days. But so that was the good thing, is to give us more descriptive titles and titles with a salary range, but that's also the downside, and don't let me forget to mention that. Titles that meant something. If you applied for a job as an advisor, you had a pretty good sense of what your job might be. If you applied for a specialist academic support, you'd have to have a pretty good description. So the positive for Hayes Hill, in my mind, is that it significantly expanded the title structure and built in promotions. You could be an associate advisor, an advisor, and a senior advisor. The distinguished business came later. So there was a built-in promotional track. That's all positive. The negative, as I see it, and this is still true, is that there were salary ranges with maxima. And if you were hired near the maximum because of your experience, it may be hard for your unit to pay you what they wanted to pay you based on what they thought you were worth. So you had to become creative with the title structure.
Who determined the maximum the salary ranges?
That was the Hayes Hill
group.
Right. I don't remember who. It was came out of the Hayes Hill project, but I don't know who actually did it.
Interesting, because it's also a challenge for us still today.
It's absolute, and it's getting worse because the ranges aren't going up necessarily as much as they should. Let me jump in here and say that the legislature, as I understand it, mandated that there be maximum salaries on these titles. They didn't want us all getting huge salaries.
And Hayes Hill is system-wide.
Correct.
And so I'm wondering, there's probably some amount of years in there where the system developed, and then they realized they had all these miscellaneous titles across all the campuses. So this was a very big deal.
Very big deal.
To even the keel.
Very big deal.
You mentioned the downside of the maximas, because those maximas apply to all campuses.
Correct.
Regardless of Research One versus two-year
Correct.
College.
And that was a source, that was a thorn in our side, frankly, because the other campuses tended to hire at the associate level. We tended to hire people with a little more experience. At Research One, as you said, we needed more experience in many of the jobs. So we were using the Hayes Hill title structure differently, just because we were a different kind of institution. So we had to. We were pushing for something at the upper level, like the distinguished, which came about somewhat later also, with a whole set of different rules.
During Hayes Hill, you know, I get the expanded title and the built-in promotions as being a good thing, but weren't some people sort of demoted out of academic staff positions, or were their jobs transitioned to classified positions?
Okay, thanks for mentioning that, Becky. That's something I hadn't thought about in a long time. But yes, in the School of Ed, which, and again, I was at the point when Hayes Hill was completed, if that's the right word, where I was working in the HR area of the School of Education for academic staff. And we had, I think it was 9 people who were, and I've forgotten what the word was, but they were targeted, that when those people left the job, either through retirement or through switching jobs, when those people left the job, the position would become classified. In the meantime, these people would have all rights and responsibilities that any academic staff member would have. And
it's
gradually...
It's got to have an impact, though, on the morale of that person in the
position.
Of
course it did. Of course it did. But the good thing was that the person knew that he or she was going to be okay as long as the person was in that job. So in some ways, the morale problem was with the supervisor, who could not replace Anna Arouge in Char's group with an academic staff person. When Anna leaves, that will become a classified position. So it affected supervisors as well.
What's your recollection or feeling of the sentiment on campus while all this is going on? Is there a general excitement about this new change? Is it confusion?
To the extent that people tend not to like change, I don't think I would describe it as excitement. It was something that we had to deal with. We had to learn how to live within it. We had to make the best of it. We had to understand it. We had to learn how to make it work for us. But I wouldn't say there was excitement at all. It was just a change that was imposed on us for reasons that, to some extent, we understood. But excitement, no, I don't think so.
So where does governance come into all this drama that's going on campus? Because you got the academic staff committee, mm-hmm. and then Hayes Hill, then you got the merger, and then you got Hayes Hill coming in. And meanwhile, MASA's trying to link people together in some meaningful way. Somehow or other, the business of governance gets...
Merger was much earlier. Merger was 1973.
Okay.
So the merger of the state system, like the UW-La Crosse, was Wisconsin State University-La Crosse, that whole group, the merger took place, I think, in 1973.
Okay. And there was the Academic Staff Committee at that time, or
I don't remember when the AOC came into being.
Okay.
Well, I'll just, a little aside here, back to my first job in sociology. I didn't even know I was academic staff. It wasn't a title that we were using. And I was trying to think, in connection with this interview, when that title came about, and I couldn't remember.
Yeah, that's what I'm interested in.
I couldn't remember when we actually called this group.
The specialist group.
Right. When we actually called them academic staff.
Sometime before you got to School of Ed, though.
Definitely. Definitely. Because I knew I wanted, one reason for wanting to move was I could go onto hard money and stay in the academic staff. So yes, it was certainly there
so,
at that
stage.
So you
had worked with Joe for 4 years. Prior to moving to the School of Ed and her early workings with this organization, MASA.
That's right. That's right.
So somewhere at MASA's Academic Staff Association, so that puts us at least 70, somewhere between 73 and 76.
Right. So I'm not aware of any, I don't remember, just don't remember what might have happened before the 74-75 year that I was absent. Yeah, I came back in 75, and that's when there was all this activity going on already that I just became part of because it was new. I truly don't remember what was going on before then.
So as an aside, it seems very advantageous in many ways that you were gone for a year and you came back, because it was like a new beginning in lots of ways.
That's true. That is true.
It's got to add to your perspective.
Right, so that was fine.
Okay, so then let's go back to the governance question. Somehow or other, it gets initiated and people start demanding that they have some policies concerning this group of academic staff people, as they're now called.
Correct. Well, I think what was wanted is the right to establish our own policies, that the legislature had to agree that academic staff would have the same kind of governance rights that faculty have had for a lot of years. And we had to negotiate for that. Before, you and I worked together on academic staff policies and procedures, which came out of governance. Before that, there was a document whose name I can't even remember anymore, but the academic staff committee created that document. Phil Hellmuth was one of the people who was involved with that. I think it was called Policies and Procedures Governing Academic Staff Appointments, and I think it was called ASA for short. So we had rules before governance, but when governance came in, and what was it, 86, 7, 8, somewhere in that area, I'm way ahead of myself here, we revised the old ASA. But there were rules before that. It was a skinny little book that was much less detailed than
so
ASPP.
There were rules, but if there's not governance, then there's no actual seat at the table. So who enforced the rules?
Okay. It was people in the dean's offices. Because each dean's, dean or director, I should say, because there are some units like the health service that don't have a dean, they have a director. Those people all had human resources people who oversaw appointments and sick leave and salaries and all those things. So that was the group that was overseeing the appointment structure. And they were administrators of various kinds. Some were academic staff, some were classified, depending on the unit. So they had to make sure that was the law at the time. They had to make sure that those things were being followed.
So these rules, what's different about those rules and the current PPPC? So it seems to me like, okay, here's the rules, and the HR people are going to follow those rules. Mm-hmm. What's missing? Is there job security's not in the picture?
Absolutely not in the picture.
Okay.
Right. I didn't even think to do a side-by-side. I have a copy of ASA somewhere at home. And it was interesting, and this is a personal aside that nobody else will say. When we looked at ASA, which I'd been dealing with as a dean's office person for a while, I looked at that and I said, oh, this looks pretty good. What would I want to change? I can't think of anything. And we promptly proceeded to completely revise ASA into what's now ASPP. So I didn't think
it'd be interesting to look at those two documents and see what we kept.
Right.
What we added.
Right.
And why we added it. So job security, we know, is one.
Right.
Go back
to
your why.
Well, but the why is it was benefiting academic staff. We didn't have any rights regarding promotions or job security. And we wrote that into ASPP very strongly and kept improving the rights as time went on. I could argue that ASA was more of an administrative document. Although there were academic staff members who on ASC who wrote it, it was partly from the administrative standpoint because those were the folks who had the understanding of how the system worked.
So why governance? You know, we got rules. We don't have job security, but there's no voice saying you should have it.
That's a very good question, Becky. The why governance probably had a lot of reasons. Faculty had it. They had some say in their procedures, in their appeals procedures, too, for example. We have an appeals committee, and others, let me back up a step. We were very much modeled on the faculty style with representation. They have a Senate, we have an assembly. We stole a lot of things from the faculty just because it was an issue of why reinvent the wheel. And I think people understood that we could gain some benefits, or at least to use your expression earlier, we were at the table. We could be at the table, and we would be the ones who would be making some of these decisions through a legitimated process. That the legislature or the faculty or the campus administration or whoever would see this governance structure as legitimate, just as the faculty governance structure is legitimate.
Well, and they eventually had to accept it.
Correct. So well, when the legislature passed it, it's there. And then we had to work out how to fit in. We weren't taking anything away from the faculty, at least not that I remember. We were just trying to create our own niche and our own rules.
So it's interesting because as a person on campus, looking at how we come to have the personnel policies and procedures and knowing that a lot of that grew out of language that was used by faculty, I now see that as a little bit of a harness on us, that we say we're different than faculty, we're professional staff, but we're going to model ourselves after how you do things. Yeah, we're different from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you have any thoughts now on whether we need to revisit that model, whether we need to adjust any of the parameters, because we aren't faculty, and to try to fit into that faculty model, one example would be the tenure versus indefinite appointment.
Mm-hmm.
They're very different things, yet mm-hmm. the process fits for faculty. I'm not sure it fits for
right.
indefinite appointment. So
especially because it has changed. And the indefinite appointment is a good example of that. I don't know if it's, remember, I've been gone from campus now for, 4 years,
right.
almost. And I've not kept up with all the changes that have taken place. But I know that before I left, indefinite appointments were becoming less frequent. Deans did not want to stick their neck out and make this long-term commitment. Even to somebody who was a stellar employee and whose job had an indefinite future. You could not imagine running your operation without this kind of person. They just became skittish with various budget cuts about making the commitment to academic staff, because we, after all, are the campus's flexibility. When a tenured professor has an appointment or a classified staff member has passed probation, they essentially have permanent positions unless there's a financial emergency. So we were the flexibility. And so what we tried to do is get whatever job security was appropriate, given the person's situation. If you're a researcher on a grant, you're not going to get an indefinite appointment. But there are others, like the librarians, who were prominent recipients of indefinites. Those were appropriate, and the director was content with that. So,
indefinite appointments, they were with the person, though, not with the position.
That is correct.
So it's curious to me that people are reluctant to, if they like somebody and they know they can't run their unit without that person, it's not as if they're committing to having that position all the time.
Correct.
They're just committing to the person.
To that person, right. But again, it removes your flexibility. You can't get rid of that person. I mean, you can if it's, you can dismiss anybody for cause, including a tenured faculty member. But it just makes it harder. You know that I advocated very hard for indefinite appointments to the extent that it was reasonable to give those. And that was one thing. There's a question here at the end, what were you most proud of? And one thing that I would put on that list is advocacy for the academic staff in the School of Education. Because I understood the unit, I could recommend to the director and to the dean certain things about the people that I thought were appropriate given what the unit was about.
Indefinite appointments cannot be given to all academic staff, right? So you can't get an unlimited appointment.
No, but I had an indefinite on my backup.
Okay. So
yes,
technically
you're absolutely right. Not unlimited, because those need to be, by the nature of limited appointments, those serve at the pleasure of the supervisor, like the dean. And the chancellor right now has the right to have her own people around her.
Right.
And so what you do is put the indefinite on the backup, which is either a title, usually, or I think mine was pretty general.
So, yeah, you know how I always was on the PPPC, like I'm searching for the logic in how these things are received on campus, and I think, okay, so here you are, person who the School of Ed relied very heavily upon for many years. You've got an indefinite on your backup. So technically, right. they can still remove you from your limited position.
Right.
And move you over to some corner of campus somewhere to ride out your time. But yet, they're still, the indefinite obligates them to pay for you then? Is that, what's the fear?
The fear is that you've locked in a budget line.
But if they remove you based on your limited position, do they still got to pick up your salary?
That's the point. If I okay. had been removed from my assistant dean position, I would have gone into my, and I've forgotten what the backup title even was. I didn't use it, so I didn't know what it was. But I could, for example, if John Palmer had, or Chuck Reed after him, had said, "Ann, I don't want you doing what you're doing. I'm going to put you over in the Wisconsin Center for Education Research to be their HR director." He could have done that.
Okay.
Because of the limited and because of the indefinite. And I would have had my indefinite on my appointment in this other unit. The job security doesn't go away.
Now, though? Is Chuck Reed still paying for you? Is the other unit paying for you?
That would have to be worked out.
Okay.
And the deans work that sort of thing out all the time.
Yeah, we'll pay it first year.
Right, right. That's the kind of thing. Right. We'll pay the first X years of this person, and then if you like her, then you can pick it up. And that also, the answer to that question depends on what the, and what's the term for it? The unit. Help me out here. The unit. My indefinite was in the School of Education. Ginny Cruz's was in the Cooperative Children's Book Center. So hers was much more limited than mine. Mine, because it covered the whole...
Because she would have to go to another cooperative.
There is no other. But the point is, if the CCBC went away, okay. so would Jenny's appointment. And she knew that. But
okay.
Jenny was a CCBC, so there was no issue with that. But I'm talking about the operational area. That's
okay.
the word I...
operational area.
That's what I'm trying to say. Mine was the whole School of Education, which was by far the better deal.
Right.
Because then Chuck or John could say, okay, you're going here, and so forth and so forth. Whereas if they closed the CCBC, Jenny would be out of a job.
But she could still have an indefinite.
And she did, and she retired from it. Because she was the CCBC. Jenny knew that. So she didn't need to feel any insecurities. But she was a person that we knew was safe with an indefinite because she was so good and because she was the unit. She was helpful in getting it started and directed it for a long time.
So indefinites are not the same kind of job security that tenure faculty.
Absolutely not.
Talk a
Absolutely
little bit about
not.
Other differences between those two.
Well, there's something in ASPP that we had to put in there that says that there's a guarantee of 2 years in an indefinite appointment. They can't, I don't remember the language anymore, but the idea was that if your unit closed, for example, they owed you a position for 2 years, which was the reason for the argument that some people said a 3-year rolling horizon is better than an indefinite. And I said, no way, never, not the case, because of the order in which you would let people go if you had a budget crunch. I just lost my train of thought.
Well, we're differentiating the indefinite
from
the tenure.
Tenured people can be dismissed for cause if they do something egregious, or if there's a fiscal emergency of some sort that's laid out by the legislature. That is another way that they can be let go. Doesn't happen. Okay, we haven't had to declare that sort of thing. But we're in tough times right now. It wouldn't be completely bizarre if somebody said, we need to close the such and such unit. And then those people, the tenure faculty, would be on the line. But it's a different understanding that the legislature and the state, people in the state seem to understand that tenure is what it is. Once you pass your probation and prove that you're a super faculty member, you have the right to stay. And you understand the reason behind tenure. It was because of academic freedom. You could, if you were a person in a controversial area who believed some controversial things, let's say about race, you could espouse your controversial ideas and not lose your job because of it. Academic freedom was protected by tenure. I think that's one reason that tenure came about. Not so much the job security, but the ability to say what you felt was the truth.
Which in a sense is job security, right?
So correct.
You're locking in.
Correct. But it was just different for us. There are academic freedom issues for some academic staff as well.
So there really isn't a true equivalent for tenure. Indefinite's as close as
no,
we get.
No, it's as close
and
as we, right.
still.
And it's not being offered frequently.
Which is, to me, a curious thing, because it's really not the commitment that, I guess indefinite might be a scary term for some, but it's really not.
That is correct.
Indefinite. You can
there's
still
a way
make,
out of it.
And there's no upfront financial commitment. You're simply committing to this person being in this position. So it's frustrating for me to think, why are we not doing that?
Right. And we've tested the person. You don't, with some exceptions, the library has been known to give indefinite appointments when the person steps in the door, because they came from an institution with tenure. They couldn't recruit the person unless they had an indefinite. That's not my understanding of what the indefinite is. Most people on campus get the indefinite after whatever number of years is prescribed by the unit. In the School of Ed, it was 5 years, although I sneaked through in 4 years. We won't talk about that. If you've watched somebody perform for 5 years, you have a pretty good sense of what kind of an employee they are. So there shouldn't be a risk. Yes, that's what you're saying. There shouldn't be the risk.
So it seems like that maybe is a modern issue that academic staff should be engaging in conversations about, because it's not even the same kind of commitment as tenure, and we're losing it.
Right. Right.
What's interesting to me, and it seems like when Hayes Hill came on board, as I'm able to understand it, that each campus was obligated to use these title series, but implemented them in different ways. So you have UW-Milwaukee still offering these probationary appointments, and that's sort of what they chose to do. And Madison chose not to do those kind of appointments. Do you recall at all, like, what the rationale was going
Absolutely. On there? Absolutely. Absolutely. The probationary leading to indefinite was modeled on the faculty's probationary assistant professorship leading to tenure. But the problem with the probationary is it's up or out. Madison figured out very early that they could promote people to, I think that's the right word, they could give people indefinite appointments after they had proven themselves however many years. And if the person hadn't achieved that level of success in 7 years, they weren't out the door. Whereas if you were brought in on a probationary appointment, 7 years, you didn't get your indefinite, you're out the door. We said, why
did we ever do those?
Yes.
We did. And
yes.
How many people actually were out the door after 7 years?
I don't think very many. Because you don't let them get to the point of 7 years. If you make a hiring mistake, you deal with it long before 7 years. You just let the person go. And you can do that during the probationary. You can let somebody go for cause.
And you have the whole 7 years.
Correct.
It seems to me that there is some advantage to going, maybe considering the use of those appointments more.
Except that it's up or out.
Yeah, but if nobody's really, I mean, if, like you said, you're getting the bad people out before the 7 years, you're requiring HR managers to be paying attention, as opposed to, you know, individuals who are not on probationary appointments. They come on board and they're really not star performers, but they're not doing anything egregious.
Right.
It seems we're more stuck using the model we currently use than if we used more probationary appointments.
Well, now I would put my HR person hat on, because you should be dealing with those people. A good HR manager, the person from the dean's office who oversees HR matters, should be getting to the people who have these mediocre employees and saying, figure out how to deal with them.
Is that happening?
In some areas, yes. Because the people are more engaged, the HR people are more engaged with their units. The units are more accepting of what advice they're being given. Some units don't want advice. Just leave me alone.
But it just takes one bad unit, right,
to
ruin a whole potential process. And one of the recollections I had that was one of my biggest learning moments on the PPPC was how often HR people were not either engaged in the issue, or units weren't aware that they should be engaging the HR office. So that there is a, I think, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, there is a no small number of people on campus who I think are not worth our investment, but...
Absolutely, absolutely. And what you're describing refers to the people at the supervisory level in the departments. There are some supervisors who say, oh, you know, old Joe is doing okay. I just don't want to spend the time with him. He's doing some things okay, and it will be more of my time to get rid of him than to coach him. Coaching is a very good way to work with people and help them do things that they aren't doing for you.
And who should be doing the coaching?
The person who understands what needs to be coached.
Okay.
It's often the PI, but the PI may have a lot of a lot of responsibility. Some of the bigger projects have their own HR people. If they're huge, I mean, Jamie Thompson must have an HR person because he has a big operation and some very strong. He can't be the scientific brains behind it and the managerial force behind
right,
it.
Right, that's where I think is the crux of the issue.
Correct.
Is that just because you're a manager or an HR person or a PI doesn't necessarily mean you also have these coaching abilities and or good interpersonal skills.
Correct, or the understanding of what needs to be done. You may be a terrific stem cell researcher. I don't know Jamie Thompson, so this is nothing against him. I shouldn't have probably used that name, but I'm just saying he's a very prominent person right now.
He's a popular name, I guess.
And he's a very prominent person.
Well, and what's interesting to me that you bring him up, because I often use him as an example of before his fame, he was an academic staff member.
You know who pointed that out? Moi.
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
Well, it just that everybody assumes it because he's such a stellar researcher. And he moved very quickly through the tenured ranks. But I looked him up on the personnel system. And here was this title, I don't know, assistant research veterinarian or whatever he was. I said, that's an academic staff title. This guy started off as academic staff.
And I think that's part of one of our dark shadows as academic staff is, even though I embrace my role as academic staff, I don't want to be a faculty member. I feel like I contribute in many mm-hmm. equally good ways. Mm-hmm. Yet there are a lot of academic staff who don't feel that way. They really feel like if I could just make that leap over to faculty, I would have more prominence associated with me. I've talked with many academic staff members in small departments who are the only one. And
yes.
They're not allowed to go to faculty meetings.
Yes.
Talk about your thoughts on what we can do about that.
It's really an individual kind of thing that the person, I'll pick on my friend Carla Love, because she was just mentioned to me by a mutual friend of ours over there in the lobby a few minutes ago. Carla is, because she's so good and is so well respected in the German department, it's my advice to anybody like that, although Carla doesn't need my advice on this topic, go to your department chair and suggest that in other areas, they need to be more proactive is what I'm saying.
They need to be proactive, but proactivity alone is not going to create the, you know, embracing of your role.
Your role or your presence at these meetings. But I have one department which needs to remain anonymous for reasons that become obvious that has gradually opened up its what they call still faculty meetings, although they really are departmental meetings, to more members of the academic staff. Because they realize that here are people who can tell us things about all sorts of ways that we are managing our department. Things about our students, things about our programs. If you get a chance to demonstrate how you can be helpful, sometimes people understand better. But it's tough.
So I might also add that to the list of one of our modern challenges is to academic staff needs to feel that they're a major contributor alongside of faculty.
Correct. As you said earlier, not trying to take the place of faculty, but trying, this is my role, and here's how I can help you.
And both, the university cannot run with one or the other of those groups.
We know that. Well, just, you can throw the classified staff in there, too.
Right.
I mean, we talk about academic staff feeling put down. Classified staff feel even more put down.
So, for purposes of the interview, talk about these classified staff. Who are they? I mean, it took me a long time to be on campus to realize that meant something.
Absolutely. It's a category of appointment. And depending on where you work, you have a different understanding of who the classified staff are. Because I grew up professionally in the sociology department, the classified staff to me were two categories of people, the staff in the departmental office, we used to call them secretaries, and the maintenance people. That was the two categories of academic staff. I didn't know that we could have classified attorneys, and the incoming president of our retirement association is a nurse who worked 44 years at the University Health Service. She was classified staff.
Yeah, I did not know that either.
Professional,
so then
very
what's
capable.
Different between classified staff and academic staff? What distinguishes you from being one or the other?
Oh, it's statutory. Your job is set up. First of all, academic staff have to have degrees. With the possibility of some waivers out there. Many classified staff have degrees too, but they're not required as a condition of the position. there may be some exceptions like that in the State Department of Health, whatever it's called now, where physicians need to have an MD. But basically, it's not degree-based. It's based on the jobs. Classified staff don't have governance rights, so they're the non-represented classified staff are working more. The Council for Non-Represented Classified Staff has sort of they're modeling themselves after us in terms of their, quote, governance.
Well, and that's a really cloudy one for me, because the classified staff, I understand, can be all these different types of people, but they can move. They're not obligated to be in one state agency over another. They can do
Correct.
Their jobs in a multitude of agencies.
That's
where
right.
Academic staff are specific to higher ed.
Pretty much. That's the definition. And thank you, Becky. That is exactly the definition of academic staff. And I can't quote it anymore, but it relates to that it's specific to higher institutions of higher education or their administration. So, for example, a registrar is the administration of a university.
Right, and you can't be a registrar at,
DNR. No. Right, right.
So then you got this other group that comes in. Now these are the non-represented classified
right.
staff. So they still can work in different agencies, but they are at the administrative level, so they're not union members.
Correct.
So they're sort of this floating
Correct.
Layer in between.
Right, and they do
a rock
feel
and a hard
they
place.
Do feel in limbo because they don't they don't have the academic staff governance structure to protect them, and they don't have the union structure to protect them. They're people like the department administrators. That's my classic example of the non-rep classified. There are others too. But they want their voice. They want their voice heard too, and they've made positive steps. They often serve now on search committees for the provost. Let's just say, I'm not for sure that that's true, but my guess is that there are classified staff on, and the people you choose tend to be your non-rep classified because they have more flexibility with their hours, just as academic staff do. Many classified staff are limited to 7:45, 11:45, et cetera, et cetera. So they're finding their niche and their way to be heard. Everybody wants to be heard.
Imagine that.
We have opinions. We want somebody to care.
At an institution of higher education where we espouse learning. So we're coming up on an hour, and we got about like 8 minutes. I think we should think about how we'd want to close chapter one. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about, so we've got all these changes that are going on back in, the 80s, Hays Hill. People are getting governance. They're starting to be active. There's a lot, in my memory, the stories I've heard, I get the sense that there was a lot of activism going on, but I haven't heard you talk much about what some of those fights were and where you're at in that decade as you feel like these are the things we really cared about then. And then later, I'm hoping we can tie that back to what we care about now.
I didn't feel, because I'd had such good work situations, I didn't feel oppressed the way many people did. Because I worked, particularly in education, I had the dean's ear. I always felt
privileged.
Hurt. I was very privileged, and I know that. But I didn't...
You use it, right? I mean, you use the privilege to help.
Well, I hope so. I mean, that was my idea.
So even though you're not involved in it, you're seeing it. Your good friend Joe Elder is living it.
Right.
What's your recollection of that stuff? What do you recall Joe getting really worked up by?
It's hard to think about that. There were salary issues because the faculty were setting. She was for a long time one of very few academic staff in sociology. Her salary was set by faculty through maybe not a very good process. Faculty could submit their brag sheets, we could call them. I think they were called professional activity reports or something, but they're brag sheets for the year. And that's what the faculty budget committee looked at to decide upon a faculty member's piece of the 7% salary. We don't know 7% anymore.
Was this a campus-wide group? Or did
each department.
Each department
had its allocation from the college level. And if it's a 2% year, for example, they got to decide how the 2% was allocated. If the stakes are that small, it's not as big of a deal as if it is. There were 7% increases way back when.
Not in my day.
Not in your day, no. But the idea was that the faculty could could submit something that might increase the chances of getting a higher salary increase.
And so the faculty determined what they were going to give each other, and they also determined this academic staff person on their unit. So right off the bat, you can assume what's going on there.
Now, that's in Joe's day.
Okay.
That changed a little bit later when some departments put an academic staff member on the budget committee. So that person could speak for, advocate for the colleagues in the department.
Some departments.
Some departments, correct. And you aren't even in a department.
Right.
You see, you have a director who decides what your salary is. And he or she can decide, does he want to make a unilateral decision or does he want to have a committee? Those things. Establishment of salary was a big one from the beginning. From the beginning.
There is, I think, some carryover, what I'll refer to as another dark shadow of academic staff, which is many, because we're so varied, many people don't understand us. We are almost always more closely identified with this classified group. Any thoughts about getting out from under that based on this? I mean, the salary issue is a big part, and job security is a big part.
I'm not sure my perception is the same as yours, because there are some people who are academic staff who are almost indistinguishable from faculty. In the medical school, for example, the CHS, quote,
those.
Faculty, they're academic staff.
Right.
But they're treated by their dean as faculty. They identify themselves as faculty. I see their applications for the Retirement Association coming in as faculty. You look them up on the tube and it says that they're CHS. They're academic staff. They just don't even know
right.
that.
I totally agree with that. I think that connects back to this yearning of like, well, I'm more faculty than I am academic
right.
staff. I'm talking about, from an outsider perspective, people who don't understand these academic staff, that who would never in a million years guess that there are clinical people who are academic staff. They would not get
right.
that.
Why aren't they faculty? How many times did I get that? Aren't
right.
they faculty?
Right, so that's what I call the dark shadow. Like,
yeah.
It goes back to, why isn't it good enough to be embracing academic staff title?
Because people don't understand it. If you say you're a professor, I mean, I went through that a lot early in my career. If you were a woman on campus, you were either a professor or a secretary. Or a, what was my third example? I can't remember. But anyway, I was not faculty. I fought against that secretary image really hard. I said, that's not my job. That's not what I do. Sure, as Steve Lund says, everybody stands at the copy machine. You all do some things like that. We all type now at our computers, but it was people didn't understand that there were more kinds of people than just professors and
Do you think they'll secretary. Ever understand that?
No, they don't care. It doesn't matter to them. All they want to know is that when they call the Department of X, they can get their question answered. They don't care who does it, if it's a faculty or an academic staff or a classified staff. There's
no
station there.
Should we care about that?
We can't fix it.
So we need to
embrace can't
it,
make somebody
like.
Care. We have our, I guess maybe that's why I was so heavily identified with academic staff in my career, is that I just, that was who I was, and I was happy to talk to people about it. But the differences were prominent to me, but not to lots of others. And there came a point when it didn't matter. Do I care if Joe Public doesn't know that I'm academic staff? Not really.
It's interesting that you would say that, because it seems like Joe Public has a very big say in how we are perceived and treated, though. You know, when you talk about legislature and senators who are voting for these salary increases or wanting to give faculty and teaching academic staff more money than this other group,
yes.
is all a result of Joe Public not getting it.
Yes.
So
and again, because they don't, there is a conflict. They don't understand. If we're not like faculty that is doing teaching or research, we belong with this other, that still steams me. If you're not doing teaching and research, which is what the faculty do, ignore the public service piece for a minute, then maybe you're like all these other people that work in the various state agencies and you should be classified. Forgetting the rule about the relevance to higher education.
Well, and there are academic staff who just teach, or academic staff who just do research,
correct.
Right? And but there is
correct.
Some rule in there that if you're doing both of those things, then you need to be reviewed. Is that true?
Well, my understanding is that you may not be doing all three of the faculty legs of the stool,
okay.
teaching, research, and public service. So let's pick on Carla again. She's an instructor, and she does committee work, which one could argue is service. If she were to get into the research area, one could argue that she would be more appropriately in the faculty, and she needs to stop doing one or the other. That's kind of artificial also.
Or she could decide, well, maybe I want to move towards faculty. I mean, are faculty sort of opposed to that idea that academic staff could morph? I mean, Jamie Thompson morphed.
Yes, Jamie Thompson morphed, and who's the woman in German, in Carla's very own department? I'm not remembering her name. Her husband was a faculty member. She was a PhD in German, who was an academic staff member for a long time. And then when he passed, I think he had to pass away before they let her go onto the faculty, or maybe he had to just retire.
Hmm.
So she moved. It is possible to move from academic staff into faculty. It requires a lot of
So it seems
politics.
Like, you know, you're just better to try to either choose early on which one of those paths.
Right.
And try to stick to your...
Right. And be a good whatever you are. And then try to, if there are things that you as a lecturer don't get that faculty get, could you get a piece of that? Could you get a trip once in a while to go to a conference or whatever? I mean, you work on whatever you can, what really is important to you.
I wholeheartedly agree with that concept. I think what's frustrating to me, and any closing thoughts you might have on this is, I embrace that. I get that. I know I got certain skills in areas to maybe motivate people. I'm frustrated when people don't even have enough motivation to even care about the fact that they are contributing to the university and should just care about that slice alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not asking you to go out and recruit and do anything other than just care that you're an academic staff member.
Right.
Do you have any closing thoughts on that? Any similar frustrations that you have had? Or?
Sure, because you're right. Some people don't care. And I think what I tried to do to the extent that was possible in my little world, I didn't have any, I didn't even have control in the School of Education, but I had some inroads into various places there to try to make people understand why it mattered to them and what the benefits were of being academic staff and what you should learn about your appointment so you can make the best use of your situation. Because I've always said that information is power. You need to know more about your own appointment, for example, what the constraints are. Learn about these things, and then you can advocate for yourself.
You took it upon yourself to educate those members.
To the extent that they would listen, sure. Because I felt it was in their interest. And most people were pretty receptive because they could see what the purpose was, that they would be benefiting from.
So you say most people were receptive. There were some people
who didn't
care.
Even
after all that, were just like...
Who didn't care. Right.
And then, I guess, what can you do?
Right. You inform those who wish to be informed, and you help those who wish to be helped. That was something else that was important to me, is being available to answer questions when somebody stepped off and tried to do something and got stuck. Now what do I do? It was very satisfying to be able to help them through some of that stuff because there wasn't anybody else to do it. They didn't know about Steve Lund. My sources of information.
Well, even when you do know about Steve Lund,
he's very busy.
All of campus.
That's correct.
Retired in 2005. You came back for 9.5 months to help Dean Underwood.
Mm-hmm.
Have they replaced your position?
Nope. I knew when I left that the budget line was wiped out.
So is there anybody now taking on that role of educating those members?
Afraid not. And people say very nice things periodically when they see me. They've just gone through a search, and they didn't have the benefit of what I could help them with on the search. And they said, we managed, but it would have been nice to have you there, or when it comes to an issue of a promotion or some other aspect of the rules. There's just no one to discuss that with anymore.
So who takes care of all the stuff that you did, the appointments, the knowledge? The
knowledge is come see, come saw. The paperwork is handled by staff members in our business office, who may or may not have any tenure. Pat Gavin's been there forever. He was working in the School of Ed before I was. So he handles some of the paperwork and some of the trickier questions because he's the experienced person. But the others are not very senior.
So do you feel, do you agree with that decision not to replace?
Of course not.
And is that a trend that we should be watching on campus? It seems to me everything we've talked about up to this point is the importance of people like you who may be in privileged position to help those understand where they can go and how to get involved. That's been a common thread. And if the likes of your role starts going away, are we moving in the other direction?
I don't know if that's likely to be a common occurrence. I don't know of any other place that that's happened. Our business manager was faced with a huge budget cut this particular year, and it was very nice. I was an anomaly also because I was working directly for the dean. I was not working for the business manager, which is where all the other HR people, the people who process all the paperwork,
okay. They
all report to the business manager, and they're part of the business office staff. I was not, and I think that bugged some people. And so it was just easy. We'll just bring this function into the dean's office, and we'll save all this money, and that's the end of it.
Well, I think now is a good stopping point.
Okay.
And we'll pick the story back up on Friday.
All right. Very well.